This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Richard Aidy. This is The Money. Today, how immersing herself in poker made one woman a much better decision maker. Hell of a learning curve, though.
I really did throw $10,000, which is a lot of money. It's not money I can afford to lose, but I basically threw it down the drain because I let hubris and what I wanted to have happen and get in the way of objective assessment.
Who she is, why she did it, what she learned, all coming up later in the show. On Tuesday, the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, hands down the budget. Like all budgets, it lays out the government's plans for the economy over the next few years. But that's where the normal bit stops, because this budget will be unlike any other in my lifetime in terms of what it will spend. We could try to predict how much that will be and where it will go, but it's much more interesting to ask a couple of economists what they would do if they're in charge, if they were the absolute monarch of Treasury. So joining me now are Andrew Charlton from Alpha Beta and Sarah Hunter from Oxford Economics. Welcome both of you back to The Money. Sarah, I want to start with you. What's the top of your wish list?
I think if we're talking about stimulating the economy and how the government can most effectively do that, so infrastructure investment is an obvious candidate, and really focusing on both smaller shovel-ready projects is how we like to describe them, that can get off the ground really quickly, so we can really drive jobs very quickly there. Are going to be pretty important. I'm also looking to see what they do in terms of supporting consumer spending. So, hallmark of this recession is that it's consumption-led. That is very atypical. Normally, recessions are led by business investment and turns in those cycles. This one is different. So anything, seeing what they can do that will drive an upturn in consumer spending will be pretty important too.
All right, Andrew, what about you? What do you think in terms of infrastructure that we should be looking at?
Well, certainly we need to be doing things that operate in the short term over the horizon. That is going to be important to maintain jobs and support business confidence. You know, the Anzac Bridge was one of the policies that was announced as one of the stimulus measures for the recession of the early 90s, but that wasn't shovel-ready at all. In fact, by the time they had turned aside on the Anzac Bridge, the recession was well and truly over. So that's an example of what not to do when it comes to using infrastructure to stimulate the economy. I think there's a range of projects that are out there. I think the opportunity to upgrade the NBN, which the government has taken, is a really good idea. There are crews that have been out there finishing the build, and enabling those crews to continue will support jobs and also deliver really important national infrastructure. Mm. So that gets a big tick. I think some of the potential infrastructure around supporting the clean energy transition is a really valuable opportunity right now to deliver both stimulus as well as supporting our movement towards addressing climate change. There's lots of space in universities as well to think about how do we retool our education system so that coming out of COVID, we have a strong system that can support the skills of the future.
Okay, after infrastructure, what else, Andrew, would you like to see?
Well, look, fundamentally, this budget has to execute a pivot in the government's response to the crisis. The first part of their response to the crisis has been stopping the fall. And they've done a really strong job of pumping an enormous amount of money into the economy through JobSeeker, JobKeeper, and other programs that have ensured that businesses remained open and workers kept their jobs. Now they need to pivot away from stopping the fall to starting to build the recovery. And that means a very different set of policies. And as JobKeeper and JobSeeker start to wind down, we need policies that give long-term confidence back to businesses so that as they lose JobKeeper, they decide to continue to keep those workers on because they can see the pipeline of activity out there. So infrastructure is a great example of that, but there are many other policies as well that are going to be required to give people confidence that the pipeline of recovery is there and confidence to maintain jobs.
So something that would encourage investment, basically.
Exactly. I think we've had a big decline in investment, and so there's a really strong opportunity right now to introduce new policies, and there are a few on the table, including the investment allowance, to support business investment, both in big businesses and small businesses. I think there's also space for sort of broader structural reform as well. I think we have a moment right now where people are thinking about how can we make some tough decisions, implement some reforms to set Australia up for the next 30 years of growth.
One thing that governments do like to talk about before budgets, in fact, quite a lot before budgets, is tax cuts. Sarah, is that something you'd like to see?
I think for me, looking at tax cuts and particularly focusing on personal income tax cuts, there's been a lot of discussion about those just recently. The ones that are most effective in terms of stimulating demand and driving the economy in the short run will be very much focused on lower income households. So the increase in the top of the bracket for the 19%, for instance, which is slated to go up on 1st of July 2022 at the moment, potentially bringing that forward. But supporting those lower income households, it can be very effective. They tend to spend much more of their income proportionally than they save compared to higher income households. So if we're looking at ways of driving the recovery, particularly around those consumer sectors that have suffered the most in terms of the downturn, that can be very effective. In terms of broader tax reform and thinking about supply side changes, and to Andrew's point about using this as an opportunity to make some of those structural changes that will improve the growth environment going forwards, tax cuts, corporate tax cuts, can be part of that. They do help at the margin to stimulate investment. I think there's probably other broader reforms though around red tape and encouraging new business formation and those kind of changes that are potentially more effective. And the key here is we need to set the platform for the economy to be able to evolve, move into new industries and find, you know, new areas of competitive and comparative advantage, and making sure that individuals and businesses, the caution that they currently are experiencing, that doesn't become embedded and entrenched. That's going to be really critical, and how the government can enable that with a platform that encourages investment and dynamism is going to be crucial going forward.
Andrew, Sarah was saying tax reform, and of course that makes me immediately think of Ken Henry and his big changes proposed for tax, and I don't need to tell you how that ended up. Would you like to see some tax reform?
Look, yes, I would. I was in government in 2010 when the government released the Henry tax reform, and there were, 120-something recommendations. And I remember the press conference at the time when the Prime Minister and the Treasurer stood up and they said, look, this is a comprehensive package of reforms. We're not going to do it straight away. We're going to do it progressively over 10 years. And I think in the last 9.5 years, we've done two. So if this budget does the other 118, then they will have been exactly right. I think there is a blueprint there. I think lots of the things that Ken Henry outlined in that report are still relevant. We still have a lot of very inefficient taxes, lots of state taxes, think payroll tax, think stamp duties, and a great opportunity to unlock some of those taxes that are constraints on growth and maybe replace them with some better taxes.
Sarah, you were talking before about consumer spending and how vital consumer spending's going to be. And of course, tax cuts are supposed to encourage consumer spending. Is there anything else, though, that the government could do and should do in this budget?
Yeah, there's a couple of areas that they can tackle. Again, this is very much thinking about the near-term recovery and the sectors that that have been hit hardest. I think there's potentially making some of the increases that we've seen in social security benefits, and particularly job seeker, if they became permanent increases, then again, that's a group that we know have a relatively high propensity to spend rather than save. And so that additional income that comes into those households will feed through into the economy and generate those multipliers. They can also look at some more alternative, unconventional policies. We've seen them in other countries, in fact. If we look at Germany, for instance, they've got a temporary cut to the sales tax. And that is certainly, looking at the retail data there, suggests that it's being very effective at encouraging spending. Other even more unconventional ideas from the UK, where they've had a scheme that ran over August called Eat Out to Help Out. And effectively, it was the government subsidising restaurant meals midweek for people. And a population of 75 million people, 100 million meals, over 100 million meals were taken up. Obviously, very, very positive for the restaurant sector in particular. So there's lots of different sort of very unusual in normal times ideas that they could look at to really provide some cash flow into the sectors that have most been impacted. And that's what's going to be really crucial for a lot of these businesses in these areas, particularly small businesses. They've had a number of months where their cash flow has been severely impaired, and they're going to need to repair that quickly to make sure that they don't go under.
Mm. Andrew, what about this, I suppose, direct intervention approach with the restaurant meals in the UK? They've, of course, moved away from encouraging people to go out because of what's happened with the pandemic over there. Could we see something like that here?
Look, I mean, I think it's a nice formula in terms of an intervention that doesn't just provide a direct subsidy to the businesses affected. For every dollar of government money, they're leveraging another few dollars of private money as well, which is a very clever way to provide that type of support, and also probably helps to retrain consumers into the habit of going out and spending and supporting their local shops as well. So I think it is a clever policy, and I think it's probably something that's got broader application beyond just the restaurant sector.
Now, Andrew, I want to move on to, because something you said earlier made me think. You mentioned the NBN, and of course the government made an announcement that represents an upgrade. Is there anything else on the digital side of things that the government could do? Because it doesn't really feel like the government particularly speaks digital.
Look, I think we have an enormous opportunity in digital. I thought we had an enormous opportunity in digital before COVID, and COVID has only underlined the importance of Australia's transition towards a digital economy. Digital is where so much of the global growth is, where so much of the share market value is being created, where so many of the jobs of the future are being created. So I think we have a real opportunity now to think about how do we go root and branch, sector by sector, small business to large business, right throughout our economy to try and accelerate Australia's transition into the digital era. And I see that challenge as no smaller than the challenge that the Hawke and Keating government took on in the 80s and 90s to take advantage of the globalisation trend. The digitisation trend is as big as that trend. And so I think there is a very wide range of reforms in the public sector, but also a lot of change that's needed in the private sector in order to adapt to that new digital economy. A lot of businesses have woken up during COVID and realised the need to really accelerate their adoption of new technologies, and we should be riding that wave to support the transition of the Australian economy over the next decade.
Is there anything you'd like to see in terms of skills or training, Andrew?
You know, absolutely. I think we've been talking about how we make our skills and training system appropriate for the 21st century for a long time now. You know, we still have a system that, by and large, brings young people in at the age of 18 or 19, gives them 3 to 5 years post-secondary education if they're doing a longer course. Attaches a debt to that, pats them on the back and says, good luck for the rest of your life. And that model is just no longer appropriate when people are having so many different jobs in their career, when the labour market is so dynamic, when skills are changing so fast. So I think we have, you know, the university sector and the general post-secondary education sector has been really discombobulated by this crisis. And I hope we use that as an opportunity to invest in that sector, to reinvigorate that sector and refocus that sector on a sector that's able to deliver the kind of constantly upgrading skills that Australians will need throughout their lifetime as they move into more dynamic careers and take on different skill sets.
Sarah, do you think that there is a prospect of the government taking it on in this budget?
Well, there's certainly a prospect, and and certainly some of the more immediate supports that they announced back in March and April were actually sort of had one eye to this, like the direct support for apprenticeships, for instance, and keeping apprentices in their roles. So that's obviously partly that's preserving their income, but it's also partly an eye on preserving their training and making sure that they don't lose that. I'd also say what's really, really important is the reskilling of the workforce. So inevitably, with this recession, with all recessions on all economic downturns, you end up with some acceleration of the structural change. For instance, the shift to online and away from bricks and mortar retail is just one example of that. That will leave some workers where their skills, their previous role and their skills that were attached to that are just not going to be as valuable and as needed. And that sort of realization will have happened. Those people will need support, and they're typically going to not be new entrants to the workforce. Indeed, they're more likely to be older members of the workforce who, you know, are not ready to retire, and we wouldn't want to lose them from the workforce, but they're going to need to be retrained and upskilled so that they can move into a new position, into a different area. Those people often slip through the cracks, and finding ways of getting the training to them and how we can enable them to move into a new, more productive position is going to be vital.
Well, I think the wish list the two of you have constructed is really impressive. Thank you both of you for joining me today on The Money.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sarah Hunter's Chief Economist at Oxford Economics, and Andrew Charlton's Director of Alpha Beta, which is now part of Accenture. You're with The Money on Radio National and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Aidy. What makes someone put their life on hold to immerse themselves in a game that's notoriously challenging, that you're going to be bad at and lose money playing? Poker. Because that's what Maria Konnikova did. She's written about this life-changing decision and where it led in The Biggest Bluff, and she joins me now. Maria, what prompted you to abandon everything you were good at to tangle with a bunch of men with egos the size of Jupiter?
I love that you just led with egos the size of Jupiter, because it took me a little while to figure that out, and you've just hit the heart of it right there. The reason it took a while for me to figure out is that I had no interest in poker going into this. I had no interest in games. I grew up in a household where games just weren't a thing. As far as I know, we didn't even own a deck of cards. I became fascinated by the topic of luck and the role that luck plays in our lives, and how I could learn to tell the difference between the things I could control and the things I couldn't control. You know, where does my skill as a human being, where does it end? And where does just chance and luck and all of these things, where does that begin? That's what I wanted to explore. That's what I wanted to write a book about. But that's not a book. That's just this like deep life question inquiry. When I became interested in luck, one of the things that I read was The Theory of Games and Economic Behavior, which is the foundational text of game theory. I didn't randomly read this. Someone suggested that I start looking into game theory. It's not like this is a book I had hanging around the house. And I was like, you know, been meaning to get to this.
That's a big, totemic book. This is von Neumann, isn't it?
It's von Neumann and Morgenstern. They're two authors. And this is like the seminal book of game theory. And just to be perfectly honest, I didn't get through it all the way. It was really hard going for me. But I got through enough to learn that John von Neumann, the father of game theory, was a poker player. And that this whole book, this whole theory was based on poker and on this idea that solving poker would give you some sort of a key to the most complex human strategic decision-making. Now, John von Neumann is someone who I did know something about.
Yeah.
He wasn't just the father of game theory. This is a guy who was just one of the most brilliant minds of the 20th century. He was the father of the computer. He was also one of the fathers of the hydrogen bomb.
Yeah.
So his brain just spanned everything, just a true polymath. And the fact that someone like him became obsessed with poker, that intrigued me.
Yeah.
That's what got me interested in poker.
And poker's unusual, of course, in that you're not just playing the game, you're playing the player, you're playing the opponents.
Mm-hmm.
When you decided to learn, was it hard?
Oh, it was extremely difficult. It was the first time in my adult life that I decided to jump into an entirely new field. I mean, I don't remember the last time I felt like that, when I was just a complete novice and everyone around me seemed like they knew what they were doing. And I felt like a total fish out of water. And I'm actually chuckling a little as I say that, because fish is the poker expression for a player who doesn't know what they're doing, for a total novice. So I was a fish and I was definitely out of water. I had no idea what was happening, but I knew exactly why I was at the table. I decided to pick up the game so that I could explore all of these questions of skill versus chance. And I decided that I was going to try to enlist a really, really good player, one of the best players in the world, to teach me.
I love this bit of the book, actually. I'm just going to read a bit of it. And this is how you describe approaching your future poker teacher. He's quiet, reserved, determinedly attentive. He seems to play with deliberation and precision, and he's a winner. Multiple World Series of Poker bracelets, the World Poker Tour title, tens of millions in winnings. I have chosen with care. I am, after all, about to ask him to spend the next year of his life with me, a marriage proposal, if you will, right off a first date.
I did feel like I was actually asking this person, and I'm married, he's married, you know, it's not an actual marriage proposal, but I'm about to ask someone if I can just tag along and kind of share his life for a year and be a fly on the wall throughout everything, because I've identified someone who I think I will be able to learn a lot from. And it meant a lot to me that he doesn't have a shtick, that he is reserved, that he does seem to be someone who is more interested in the game than he is in the limelight. So Eric Seidel is a one of a kind.
You have to tell us a bit more about Eric, because he is one of a kind.
He is. At the time that I approached him, he was actually number one in the world in all-time earnings. I think today he's number three or four, something like that. The list keeps changing, but one of the best, and has been around since the 80s. And that's incredibly rare, someone who's around for that long. He's a unique individual who ended up not just teaching me how to play poker, but teaching me so much about life.
I should say, if you've just joined us, this is The Money, ABC Radio National. I'm Richard Aidy. Maria Konnikova is my guest. She's the author of The Biggest Bluff, How I Learned to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win. All useful qualities in life, but we're an economic show. They're also useful in business and other things. Maria, you learn to play. You start to go to the competitions. How did you go?
Well, it depends on what point you get me. At the beginning, not well. It was definitely one of these very sharp learning curves where I just kept losing and losing and losing. And I had to learn a lot about myself, a lot about decision making, and about what types of factors you should be taking into consideration, which things are relevant, which things are irrelevant. I had to learn who I was as a human being. I mean, I knew that poker was going to teach me to make better decisions. That's why I took up the game. I didn't know that it was going to make me reevaluate who I am as a human being, but it did, because at the beginning I wasn't doing well and I had to confront a lot of things about my personality, about what was holding me back, what was preventing me from being a winning player. And then at some point, something clicked. And I say at some point, but you have to also take it with the caveat that I took this as a full-time job. So I was a writer for The New Yorker. I left. I went on leave to do this. 7, 8, 9, 10 hours a day. I was studying. I was playing. I had my mind in it. And for multiple months, nothing. Nothing was happening. And I would get very mad. You mentioned something about Eric, that he led me to things. And this is very true. And at the beginning, it's incredibly frustrating. It's very much the Socratic method, where I say, how do I do this? And he says, well, I don't know. How do you do this? Let's think about it. And I want to shake him and say, tell me what to do.
Yes, tell me now.
What to do. Give me the answer. And he wouldn't, because he told me that the power of learning to think through the process for myself was going to pay dividends. And it did.
Yeah.
Because at some point, I started winning. And I started winning at very low levels, at very small tournaments, at tournaments that, you know, cost not a lot of money at all to enter. And then he let me move up. And I struggled for a bit, and then I started winning.
There is a kind of, you know, two steps forward, one step backward, one fall backward, you know, I mean, that's... There's this moment where you sort of say, you know, what kind of an idiot pays $10,000 to enter the most prestigious poker event in the world and then fails to show up to play? When you are losing money like that, that is a pretty brutal learning curve.
It is a brutal learning curve. And I only have myself to blame for a moment like that one. I really did throw $10,000, which is a lot of money. It's not money I can afford to lose, but I basically threw it down the drain because I let hubris and what I wanted to have happen and get in the way of objective assessment. And yeah, I'd won some small tournaments, but I was in no way ready to play a $10,000 buy-in event, and I could have postponed. No one was holding my feet to the fire. No one told me I had to play this. And yet I exhibited every single one of the psychological biases that I've studied, that I've written about. It's so funny. You can understand things theoretically, and then when it comes to practically embodying them, when it comes to your own life, when it comes to your own decisions, there's a chasm there. It's such a big difference between theory and practice, between understanding something and being able to execute it.
Should have said earlier, of course, but you've got a PhD in psychology. Yes. So you're not coming into this as someone who doesn't know anything. Now, I want to get to the stuff you learn in a minute, but there's just this fascinating thing that you explore. You write about this thing in poker called tilt. Now, what is tilt?
Tilt is a beautiful word, and I hope that everyone who listens to this incorporates it into their vocabulary immediately. It means letting emotions into your decision process. So you can use it as basically any part of speech. I'm on tilt. I'm tilted. This person is tilting me. And it just means that I'm no longer thinking rationally. I'm no longer using a game theory optimal or GTO calculation. I'm no longer thinking of expected values. Instead, I'm letting my emotion get into this. And this emotion has nothing to do with the decision at hand. It's totally incidental. It's not integral to the decision process. And yet, because I'm in the moment, I'm unable to perform that calculus, and I'm using that emotion to guide me. Maybe I'm taking more risk than I should be taking. Maybe I'm taking less risk than I should be taking. Whatever it is, maybe I'm more aggressive, maybe I'm less aggressive, whatever it is isn't rational. Instead, I'm letting my gut, I'm letting the emotion carry the day. That is not the way to make decisions.
Yes, I, when I was reading this, I thought, these could be my last words, actually, when I say to my wife, you're on tilt. But they might well be my last, if I say it like that. I'd have to be careful. All right, I completely understand it, and I'm sure I have been guilty of being on tilt in many, many decisions I have taken.
All of us have. Yeah. All of us have.
What did you take away from this that's improved your life?
Oh, where do I get started? I mean, to begin with, I learned to think in probabilistic terms. I learned to actually put numbers and rational reasons, this is going straight from your tilt questions, instead of emotions and gut feelings and intuitions for why I'm making a decision. I learned that there's a big difference in saying, oh, no, I'm completely sure. Well, what does that even mean? I learned that there's a big difference between completely sure and, okay, let me actually put a number to that. Let me actually see how much I'm willing to invest in that. Oh, I guess I'm only 65% sure or 70% sure. I learned to calibrate that way, and that's not the way that the human brain normally thinks. So that's one thing. And the other thing that I would say is crucially important is that I learned to separate the process of thinking, of making a good decision, from the actual outcome of the decision. I learned that in real life, we usually take the outcome as a proxy for the quality of the decision. If something turns out well, we think it was a good decision. If something turns out poorly, we think it was a bad decision. That is not true. Poker is such a brilliant corrective for that. It shows that you can make the right decision. You can get your money in as an overwhelming favorite, and you can still lose because every decision is probabilistic. There's no such thing as a sure thing. Certainty does not exist when it comes to strategic decision making. And so you can make the right decision and get a bad outcome. And you can make the wrong decision. You can actually be an idiot who's using the wrong things and get your money in as a complete dog, and you can win. That doesn't mean you're good. That means you should never do this again. That just means you got incredibly lucky and that you should say, oh, wow, I just dodged a bullet. People don't think that way. People usually conflate the two, and it's so valuable and it's so freeing to be able to say, okay, let me focus on what I can control. Let me focus on the skill elements, which is the decision process. And then the cards are going to fall how they will, and the outcome is going to be what it's going to be. It might go in my favor and it might not. I can't control that.
When you started this, Maria, I know, and I didn't mention it earlier, but, you know, you'd had a bit of what we could say was bad luck. I think your husband and your mum had lost their jobs.
Yes.
Your grandma died. You can't do anything about your grandma dying.
No, absolutely not.
I think you'd been a bit unwell yourself. Were you able to take the poker stuff and apply it to any of that stuff?
Yes, absolutely. I had multiple health issues, and at the end of the book, I won't spoiler my own book.
No spoilers.
But there's a major health issue, and my attitude is completely different than it was at the beginning of the book, because I am able to maintain calm and a more rational approach and realize, wow, I am completely out of control. I don't know what's happening right now. Let me focus on the things that I can actually focus on. Let me see what I can do. Rather than focusing on the things that are beyond me, what's happening, kind of the health things that are just totally outside of me. And it made me much calmer. It made me much more stoic. Someone who was much better able to face these blows and say, okay, that happened and that's terrible. What can I do? How can I put myself in a position to learn from this and to be in a situation where I can get past it rather than dwelling on it? And I think it was a huge mental shift, and poker was the reason that I was able to make that leap and that I was able to let go.
Maria, thank you very much for being on The Money with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Maria Konnikova is the author of The Biggest Bluff, How I Learned to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win. And that's it for the show this week. Next week, we'll pull apart the budget while it's still warm. The Money is produced by Belinda Summer. I'm Richard Adie.